Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And it has been a very busy few weeks in the foreign policy world. I don't know if anybody's been able to pay attention to all of the many things, but here we are to try to recount them. Shall we start off with what are we drinking, ladies?
I'm drinking coffee. I just told these guys, I just woke up. It's 11:15 on a Sunday morning. I was in Taiwan for a week. My husband just said, like, I'm so sorry that you're not human yet. So that made me feel really positive about how I look and how I feel at the moment. So yeah, this is going to be a great episode. Really great.
Yeah, I have all of the coffee that I can physically stomach because my children hate sleep. That's all I really have on that point. They hate it. I don't.
I'm drinking LaCroix because I am maybe still recovering from my pour me on the plane party from Friday. I am back in Washington for good, or at least until I get sent someplace else. But I have taken all the shoes that I purchased this summer in Los Angeles and put them in a bag and brought them all home. So that is...
Wow.
Well, not literally all of them. I had to do a previous migration to really cull down my options. Anyway, I'm back in Washington. We are slightly distributed this week, and we are all trying to caffeinate and hydrate as best we can to bring our fair listeners very important foreign policy and national security analysis. And to help with that, we have one Melissa Dalton with us. Melissa, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Welcome back. We're so happy to... Well, I'm happy to have you back. I'm not happy to have you back to talk about what you're going to talk about, which is kind of how it goes for all of our guests, actually.
Yes, exactly.
Pleasure to join you all this morning, although it is a pretty dire topic. Melissa Dalton from the Center for Strategic International Studies, where I direct the Cooperative Defense Projects.
Excellent.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that you had your fancy new program. It's very exciting.
Yes, it's, a woman of many hats.
It's exactly.
Many hats, many talents, many skirts, many, many, many things. Outstanding. So before we dive into some very detailed questions on the Kurds and Syria and Turkey, we will start with our new bombshell question, because I don't believe you have ever answered this set. So can we start with what Netflix show would you pitch?
So I'm thinking kind of along the lines of how Occupied was like really important to prompt kind of broader awareness challenges of Russia coercive measures kind of before its time, that maybe something along the lines of looking at different geographic locations, different stories around the globe, looking at impacts of climate change. And you'd have to kind of play with the temporal dimension, given that climate change takes, you know, its course, its effects over many years. But it'd be really neat to kind of zoom in on, the human dimension, the community level, the political level, and the interactions amongst all those factors, and maybe pick like three or four compelling stories around the globe to try to raise awareness.
That would be awesome. You could do that.
Cool.
As you were talking, I was thinking, you guys have read World War Z, the Zombie Wars book.
Yes.
A similar take on World War Z, but a climate change version of it would be spectacular as well.
Oh, somebody call Max Brooks immediately. I think that would be fantastic. Okay, Melissa, who is your literary or fictional hero?
So a little bit of a throwback here, but I'd have to say Atticus Finch, and not for the obvious reasons, but actually because of what I think is the most important human attribute, which is empathy. When you think about interpersonal relationships, even professional relationships, whether it's in leadership or, you know, trying to be a good analyst, having an empathetic core, I think is really important. And he really epitomizes that.
Melissa, I bought my mom for Christmas a few years ago a t-shirt that says, "What would Atticus do?" So it's available on the internet if you need something like that in your life.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm very excited that there's the Broadway show right now. I definitely want to go check that out.
That's right. So exciting.
Okay, Melissa, what do you follow like a sport that is not a sport?
I'd have to say the politics of national security. You know, it is my job, but it is rather all-consuming, and just trying to follow the in and outs. Not that I'm an expert on it at all, but just trying to follow the ins and outs of that. I do try to follow pretty closely.
All right, I'm going to let Radha ask the last question since I had all the regular ones this time.
What is your favorite algorithm?
My husband is actually a data scientist, so I was trying to tap his brain this morning, but to try to be true to myself, I'd have to say probably the recommendation engine, not necessarily is my most favorite because it is kind of creepy in terms of the recommendations that pop up on Amazon or in a Google search. I won't comment on Facebook, but it is probably the most consequential algorithm in terms of tracking preferences across networks.
Outstanding. Okay, well, that's the fun bit, Melissa. Now we have to turn to much more, dire matters, I suppose.
I'm just going to take a big sip of coffee before we start this.
Yeah, you could pour some whiskey in there if you had a chance. I mean, that would be appropriate. So we are recording on Sunday, October 19th. And over the last 2 weeks, we've had a pretty dramatic reversal of force positions and U.S. policy and a number of other things with regard to our actions in Syria. And maybe I'll just give a brief recap of how we got here, and you can try to explain the longer path to this current outpost. So 2 weeks ago, President Trump had a call with President Erdogan of Turkey, and we don't have the full transcript of that call, but there was a tweet slightly later that day, or later that evening, where the president announced that we were basically going to move U.S. troops who had been working with Kurdish forces in northern Syria, and this would allow for a Turkish military operation across the border into northern Syria. That is sort of the shortest version of how we got to where we are today. This last week, there was a set of envoys. Secretary Pompeo and Vice President Pence went to Turkey to negotiate a quote-unquote ceasefire. We'll get into all of that. But Melissa, maybe you can help us understand, who are the Syrian Kurds? What is the quote YPG? And why do the kind of governments in Damascus or Ankara care about this group? And we can talk about then how they got roped into U.S. policy objectives in the counter-ISIL campaign in the region.
Yeah, and again, delighted to be joining you all again. This is a pretty complex and nuanced issue. So, it's great that you guys are wanting to get down to kind of the origin story of it. So the so-called Syrian Kurds, I think it's important to distinguish Syrian Kurds from the particular unit that's part of the Syrian Democratic Forces that the United States has been partnering with really since 2014, 2015, called the YPG, the People's Protection Units, which is the Syrian Kurdish arm of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, that both Turkey and the United States consider a terrorist organization. But the YPG is not representative of all Syrian Kurds, or, and not every Syrian Kurd is the same as other Kurds. There are Kurds that are in Turkey, in Iran, in Iraq, and of course in Syria. So this is one particular component of that broader Kurdish constellation, if you will. The United States has been working very closely with this particular element, as I mentioned, since about 2014, 2015, as part of the counter-ISIS approach. And I think what's really notable from the U.S. military's perspective is how capable and reliable this local partner turned out to be, such that very close, relationships were forged on the ground. But, this group, in terms of its history, having command and control and logistical relationships to the PKK, was problematic from the beginning, but not broadly recognized from a policy perspective. There was a very deliberate attempt first by the Obama administration and then by the Trump administration to release those two elements of policy for short-term operational purposes. And then, in terms of the Syrian Kurdish population in the context of Syria, the Kurds are a minority population, mostly in Syria's northeast, but also in northern Syria. And I think it's important to also reflect on, this is not the first time that Turkey has intervened here because of its concern about the Syrian civil war or the Syrian Kurdish presence on its borders and what that might portend going forward. I think from Turkey's perspective, being concerned about a Kurdish statelet emerging at a sub-national level that could provide safe haven for, in its view, PKK cells that could then provide reach into southern Turkey.
So let me see if I've got this right. We have a Kurdish population distributed across the region. And while many of our listeners may be familiar with U.S. partnerships with Iraqi Kurds, the Kurds in Syria are a quite distinct population, but they have ties to Kurdish organizations in Turkey, including the Kurdistan Workers Party, which we recognize as a terrorist group and has run a long-term insurgency against the Turkish government. So you could see how that's kind of fraught. But then it turns out that the one part of the Syrian Kurdish group, the YPG, was super useful in fighting ISIS, and who had established a caliphate in Raqqa and among other places. And it turns out we did not have a lot of great options. So here we are. Is that about sum it up?
That about sums it up.
Okay. So the Turks have been longstanding unhappy about our cooperation with the YPG and the YPG's military effectiveness. Why now? Like, why did... You know, the Turks have been pressuring us to allow for some sort of cross-border incursion for a while. How did this come to a head, you know, this week? Why this week amongst all other weeks?
Yeah. And actually, just one other point of nuance before we move on. Important to note that, you know, the YPG formed the core of the Syrian Democratic Forces that the U.S. has been working closely with. But actually, the majority of the SDF is made up of Arabs and other minority communities in northeastern Syria. That piece Good becomes point. Later in terms of the implications. But yeah, in terms of why now, you know, it really shouldn't be that much of a surprise, frankly, when you look at where Turkey has been, it's that threat perceptions vis-a-vis the PKK, you know, viewing them as an existential threat. The fact that President Erdogan has been quite vocal for a number of years, both publicly and privately, about his concerns. So shouldn't be too many surprises there. There was also, if we reflect back on President Trump's December tweet of 2018, that called for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Syria at that point. That followed a call with President Erdogan. So, you know, clearly there's a linkage there, too, in terms of, you know, both presidents connecting on this issue from their own points of view and threat perceptions and priorities. Unique about this instance was President Erdogan. I think there's a lot of pressures at home domestically for him politically, you know, sort of the classic acting out via foreign policy means in order to mobilize support at home is one part of the story. I think because this has been front and center for security interests of Turkey is the second. But what is also kind of puzzling in the mix is that in the month preceding the Turkish intervention last week, Turkish military forces, U.S. forces, and the YPG and the Syrian Democratic Forces more broadly had been working at the tactical and operational level to remove YPG fortifications from northeast Syria off the Turkish border because of Turkish concerns. So the real tragedy here is that there was a very deliberate move by the U.S. and the coalition to convince our local partners in Syria to remove their fortifications off the border, working closely with Turkey, and then came this political decision. So even though at a broad and strategic level, it shouldn't be too surprising in terms of where President Erdogan and where President Trump was, there had been, you know, a fairly robust effort on the ground to try to mitigate some of the risks of this happening.
So let me kind of move us a little bit forward in time then and think about the implications of that. So we have the removed fortifications, the decision to draw down forces. Let's talk both in theory and then in practice what we're seeing on the ground on how that has consequences in a couple different dimensions. And maybe we could start with the stated purpose of being there, which is containment of ISIS. So what do we think in terms of this decision and the both short-term and longer-term effects in partnership with the Kurds and other forces there, what does this mean about what we should be looking for in terms of ISIS behavior or resurgence or whatever?
Yeah. So in terms of the reason why the United States and its coalition allies were there to begin with, it's incredibly detrimental to the counter ISIS mission and really provides an opportunity for ISIS regeneration for a number of reasons. One is that the very counterterrorism partnership that was applying pressure to the ISIS insurgency has now been broken. There really is no going back in terms of the trust and confidence being broken with local partners on the ground, both the YPG as well as the broader communities that the United States and its allies were working with. So that's thing one. Thing two is that the YPG and more broadly the Syrian Democratic Forces have been providing security for tens of thousands of ISIS detainees in cells that are throughout the northeast region of Syria. And given the need to mobilize some of those forces to address Turkish intervention, there have been reports of prison breaks. There is also the broader IDP populations of Syrians and Iraqis in the mix, and over time has become intermixed with women and children that were affiliated with some ISIS members, but also broader IDP populations. And the tragedy there is that nobody really knows who is who, and it essentially creates an opportunity for ISIS to ghost into these populations and make them more vulnerable, which is both a security and a humanitarian nightmare. And then the last point that I think is more generational and also quite tragic is, you know, there's a lot of focus in Washington and internationally right now on the betrayal of the YPG, which, you know, is profound. But we shouldn't lose sight of the other components of the SDF, including the Sunni Arabs that were in the mix and did comprise the majority, who, as I understand it, based on reports that I'm hearing from the ground, are feeling like they are also betrayed and abandoned, but are not getting the level of attention or support from the international community. And this feeds into a narrative of victimhood for Sunni Arabs, which, you know, has been a leitmotif of, you know, failures of governance in both Syria and Iraq and the broader region, and is, you know, the exact ingredients that a group like ISIS can manipulate.
And let me turn us slightly, because I think the other half of this and the sort of, in some sense, the response relates to the other ongoing regional crisis with it, which is this pretty terrible Syrian civil war that's going on with the Assad regime and local forces. And I think that adds a level of complication. So maybe you could catch us up on how we think about both the Assad regime response and again, what to kind of look out for in this region, because I think now we've got a number of different forces coming in to fill the vacuum from the U.S. withdrawal.
This definitely empowers Assad's ability to take advantage of the situation. The YPG immediately, soon after the Turkish intervention, reached out to the Assad regime and to Russia for protection once it became clear that the United States was going to be precipitously withdrawing. And this was, you know, a question for the Kurds' own protection. They felt like they had no other alternative, but it has essentially ushered in the return of Assad forces, Russian air cover, and Russian forces and mercenaries. And from the south, the other backer of Assad being Iran and its militias, which have a presence just outside of Deir ez-Zor, which is further down the middle of the Euphrates Valley. So this essentially, if you roll the tape forward another couple of years, certainly, there are capacity issues for Assad to be able to truly extend governance and security into the northeast, but backed by Russia is starting to take some steps. You see the reports coming out of Russian mercenaries, Russian forces moving into bases previously occupied by U.S. forces. This is, you know, a true IO opportunity for the Russians. And, you know, Assad will also manipulate the narrative of, you know, there really is no other choice. There was an attempt alongside of the counter-ISIS effort, you know, from a security perspective, a local governance effort over the last few years to build subnational governance as an alternative to ISIS, as an alternative to Assad. And essentially, with the U.S. withdrawal, that is also collapsing. So the bitter irony is that, this plays directly into Assad, Russia, and Iran's hands. And into that mix is also very helpful recruitment messaging for ISIS.
It also strikes me it's a real blow to any aspirations of Kurdish autonomy, right? Especially which had obviously grown over the last few years. And there was not a lot of expectation that Assad and the Assad regime were going to be able to consolidate, you know, these areas in Hasakah and elsewhere back into under regime control. Now they kind of get that handed to them on a silver platter. Plus, from what I understand, you know, if the Turks have this, you know, 30-kilometer buffer zone along the border where they want to repatriate Syrian refugees, that essentially allows for Arabization of these Kurdish areas as well. So it's really an incredible boon to the Assad regime and whatever effort they want to do on some sort of post-war consolidation in the future. And just another, you know, bitter irony, as you say, Melissa, for Kurdish efforts to establish an autonomous region, which Turkey was never interested in tolerating.
That's right. And it's, you know, a bit more undercovered was the Turkish intervention into northern Syria last year in Afrin. And they're using mm-hmm. this tactics there in terms of leveraging actually Syrian Arab militias that are quite extreme in their viewpoints and in their tactics to basically go into these communities, loot them, murder, rape, you name it. And, you know, what we saw happen in Afrin is exactly what you're saying, Aaron, in terms of a demographic reengineering of these communities. And, you know, with the Turkish, they've been very clear from the beginning in terms of what their intentions are. So I think we can count on this, moving refugee populations that are not from these areas into northeastern Syria. You know, and it's interesting to think about the implications for Europe and how, you know, they may feel constrained in their options because Turkey, you know, hosts 3 million Syrian refugees. Europe has concerns about Syrian refugees' political pressures, economic pressures in their own countries. You know, so if this alleviates the burden on Turkey, are there then, you know, sort of in a twisted way, less pressures on Europe? You know, and how does that then affect their choices in navigating next steps with Turkey and the Syrian conflict?
And not to mention any implications for NATO as we have further deterioration of our relationship collectively with Turkey. So unfortunately, we are out of time, Melissa. I'm sorry we can't get you here under sunnier auspices. But thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
I want to put in a plug for the Syria Commission report that Melissa helped work on that in, you know, perhaps alternate times would have been and still has many tremendous recommendations for the U.S. government to pursue in terms of the Syria crisis. But I know a lot of very thoughtful work was put in on that by Melissa and her fellow commissioners. So if you have not checked it out, you absolutely should.
Thanks again. Moving on now to keeping up foreign relations. We could also call this is still a thing, because we are back to Brexit fun after a several week hiatus. I feel like we were all kind of collectively holding our breath just or watching the sand fall through the hourglass as we approach this October 31st deadline. And they've been busy this last week or so. I don't know how closely you guys have paid attention, but Boris Johnson did get a new deal with the European Union. And Radha, I'm going to need you to explain to me how the new deal is different from the old deal, because it seems like something that Theresa May suggested or was suggested to her. And she was like, no, as the leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party, we could never slough off Northern Ireland into some other sort of political entity. And yet, here we are? Question mark.
Yeah. So just as a reminder, one of the big sticking points in the Brexit negotiation is what to do with the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, in particular, because when the UK joined the European Union, that what had previously been a firm border, so by that I mean with passport checks and customs checks, coming back to that, was made a soft border so that you could just drive through the way you do sort of within a country. And that helped a lot with sort of tensions and claims, but also actually with criminal smuggling and a whole host of things. So fast forward to Brexit, a thing they've been trying to figure out is how do you allow the UK to leave the European Union but maintain a soft border between Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, one of which would be in the EU and one of which would not? And the answer is question mark. So Theresa May's approach had been to keep the UK and thus Northern Ireland in the customs union. So what that would mean is you would have no customs checks across the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and thus a free flow of goods. You would still have to figure out passport checks, but that seemed to be a more surmountable issue and one that you could maybe put as people were coming into the island of Ireland, regardless of whether it was to the Northern or the Republic, you could do passport checks and that would help. So Boris Johnson's plan is to basically not totally keep Northern Ireland in the European Union, but to agree that Northern Ireland would abide by all of the European Union's customs, tariffs, practices. So I have to admit,
this just makes no sense to me. Like, they're basically putting the customs union wall in the Irish Sea.
Correct. Like, so that's exactly the way to think of it. So, on the one hand, it's actually, if you were an Irish Republican, so you wanted Northern Ireland and Ireland to be sort of more together, this is actually not so crazy.
This is what it would be like. Exactly.
Which is funny because the conservatives are actually aligned with the unionists, the people who want Northern Ireland to stay with the UK. So it's a separate political question.
And Boris Johnson relies on a unionist Northern Ireland party to maintain anything even close to resembling a majority, which he still also doesn't have in Parliament. But I digress.
Right. But so the idea here is now you'd have customs checks of goods flowing into the island of Ireland, whether Northern or Republic of, to deal with maintaining a soft border. I think the best political nod they have is that it allows Northern Ireland to decide in the future if they don't want to be participating in this. But they can't do that sort of on a whim. And I think the current deal structure suggests that they would have to remain part of the customs union processes for another 4 years, but they could decide after that if they wanted to change things. I mean, it does raise a lot of practical purposes. Like, if the European Union raises tariffs, is Northern Ireland then responsible for collecting those tariffs? And then do they pay them to the Europeans because it's not a UK tariff structure, right? Like, there's a lot of enforcement questions here that I'm not sure are fully fleshed out. That having been said, it feels a little bit like, one, it is some incremental progress relative to the May proposal in the sense that people seem amenable to it and the Europeans have sort of allowed a thing they said they wouldn't allow. So that seems like a concession for Boris. On the other hand, Theresa May's plan was a thing that could be done. We know how to stay in a customs union. Like, that's a well-defined policy option. And this is much more of a made-up thing. So it requires a lot more specific clarification that we don't have to answer sort of what the effects will be. But it's a great talking point. Excellent.
So the last year has demonstrated to me that as much as I thought I might understand it, I definitely do not understand the Westminster parliamentary system at all whatsoever. However, it does not seem as though Parliament really liked this plan. Is that accurate? Nor did the British people, who appear to be very angry on the streets of London and elsewhere over the weekend.
Well, Londoners opposed Brexit overwhelmingly from the beginning. So there's sort of that. I mean, I would say there's probably a decent chance that this passes in Parliament from what I'm reading. But what they did on Saturday, it was the first Saturday Parliament sat in session since the Falklands War. So they had a marathon set of deliberations on Saturday, and Parliament voted to say that they would not vote to approve this plan until all of the legislation necessary to implement this plan is ready, which kind of helps avoid some sort of hit and run move by Boris Johnson and other Brexiteers by saying we have a deal and then failing to implement it and there's still a crash out. So it may also help answer some of Radha's questions about no, but literally how.
But which means that Boris then had to ask for an extension, which he swore he wouldn't do up and down. Except, I guess he didn't ask for it because he didn't put his name on it, which is totally not the same thing at all. It's very different.
Yeah, he sent three letters to the European Commission, one of which was required by Parliament from the last time he took the issue to Parliament to say that they, you know, because he's not allowed to crash out. He then sent a separate letter that said, even though I just requested an extension, I don't think that'd be a very good idea. Please don't grant us an extension. And I honestly lost track of what the third letter was. So so we'll see. I mean, I think that the EU probably feels a little bit like they need to grant a minor extension. The real question I have then is, depending on the length of that, does that provide time for a new general election? Boris is currently governing without a majority. There could be a vote of no confidence and they could trigger this whole thing. So we're not out of the woods yet.
Right. I also just wonder how many deals that he proposes can be, or things he proposes can be effectively blocked by the parliament before we start having votes of no confidence. Like,
yep.
Remember when he wanted to prorogue things?
He did prorogue.
But he did.
I thought they unprorogued it.
They did unprorogue it. I'm just saying.
But he, and he also, I believe, more or less dared the queen to fire him.
Yeah, he sure did.
Yeah, Liz should have taken him up on that. So.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll have more Brexit fun to return to in the coming weeks, without a doubt. Can we shift gears to a less common bombshell topic?
I am so excited about this topic. It has been, I mean, I've been in Taiwan for a week, so clearly I care about the Chinese so much more at this point, but I'm so excited about this topic.
So we're going to talk about China and Hong Kong and the NBA. And Radha, that's the Basketball Association.
I know, mostly from the news. In fact, for a while I was like, who is this guy and why do they keep telling me about him?
So again, 2 weeks ago, the general manager of the Houston Rockets tweeted in support of protesters in Hong Kong, and you'd have thought he'd set the Chinese national flag on fire. So it's been quite a few days for the NBA itself. Basically, Daryl Morey was condemned by the leadership of the NBA. There was lots of kind of sturm and drang around the specifics of the tweet. LeBron James got involved, said that Morey hadn't educated himself. Kind of all of these questions. One thing that I didn't realize is how popular basketball is in China. And it's not just because of Yao Ming, who, of course, played for the Houston Rockets, which is why I thought originally this was such a big deal. But actually, basketball in China goes back to YMCA missionaries very shortly after James Naismith, first coach of the University of Kansas, founded the game. And so it's very popular in China. Even Mao Zedong was a big basketball fan. So it's sort of a non-trivial thing to have a big basketball, I don't know, crisis or, drama associated with this. But it begs a lot of broader questions about how private entities like basketball leagues or companies like Apple or anyone else can involve themselves or comment on human rights questions or Chinese foreign policy questions and still do business with the People's Republic of China.
I mean, since that point, NBA, that there have been no NBA games shown or any references to the NBA discussion in China since shortly after Daryl Morey's tweet. And the NBA is freaking out because they have a lot of money on the line at this point. So not just the amount of money that they get paid for games being shown in China on Tencent and CCTV, but also all the corporate sponsorships, all the sales that they make in terms of gear. They have all kinds of like weird kind of lifestyle centers and training programs and as training academies, play zones in malls, lifestyle complexes, 2K league games for gamers, youth development programs. It is basically a massive, massive moneymaker for them. And if that goes south, then that kind of fundamentally changes their business plan. What I think is fascinating about this is that probably know what, as we're discussing, hardly anyone in the U.S. had any idea of how big the NBA was in China. But they also weren't really thinking about how much leverage the Chinese government has over profit-seeking entities in the United States. And now people who had no idea about that, never thought about Chinese politics whatsoever, are very much confronted with this and pretty uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, I think it's actually really interesting, like sort of personification or epitome of what we have seen and discussed about here in the trade war, in which, you know, a lot of things in China are very well intertwined and leveraged in a way that I don't think we fully appreciate when thinking about separate arms of policy and engagement with China. And so their economic and social programming is very much tied in with national identity and national security issues, very much tied in with domestic security and domestic political concerns. And so when the Chinese government has a particular view about Hong Kong protests, they can leverage that view and try to induce sort of compliance with that view through a whole host of tools, including sort of what we would think of as completely unrelated market activity, right? And in the US, we don't tend to combine market activity with our national security or even domestic security policies in the same way, or we haven't tended to in the past.
What's interesting about this is this is playing out in public in a way that deals that with Google or Apple or Twitter or other, I guess it's not Twitter, but to other entities that are active in Chinese markets would not. Or if they would, it might be on a really, really, really delayed fashion. So China has shown its hand here in a way that I think is actually going to be detrimental for it in terms of US context, or at least maybe in the short term, in making people who would otherwise not care or assume that the Chinese market is a benign entity, that it actually has going to have a lot of ramifications. I have extended this brainstorm out to like, what would this mean for national or industrial mobilization and a great power conflict? But I will spare you my thoughts on that. But it's a sort of fascinating thought bubble to go down. How much leverage will the Chinese have over all kinds of industries, not just in the technical or defense sphere, but in other factors as we go further into great power competition?
I saw one tweet that I thought summed this up, if too cheekily, but was still worth reflecting on, which was that instead of, you know, exporting liberalism to China via market forces, we have imported Chinese authoritarianism through their open market. So
absolutely.
That was definitely not what I was promised in the 1990s. So we have some thinking to do on that front.
To close out on a final point there, all that being said, I mean, it is not in the Chinese interest really to keep the NBA out of China in the long term, maybe as a short term punishment. This is a great distraction for Chinese citizens for lots of other things that they might want them to be distracted from. So encouraging, there's not really an alternative. Like there's not really a Chinese NBA equivalent that is nearly as popular. They could try to develop it, but it's not at a point where people are going to be satisfied with the alternative.
I look forward to future commentary on nascent Chinese basketball leagues.
I am so excited.
Radha's too. Okay.
I'm less excited.
I'll be honest. We have things to talk about in White House mayhem, but I don't really know how to separate them or how they're differentiated or honestly what happened for the last 10 days. So if somebody would like to lead a conversation over White House mayhem, other than apparently people, John Bolton thinks that Rudy Giuliani is a hand grenade. That's most of what I got. So where do we want to take this, ladies?
Well, so I think let me start with the slightly more boring, but you know, very on brand process point of folks coming to the Hill and testifying. You're welcome.
Yes, please do.
So for folks who are kind of following along at home, the House is running an impeachment-ish inquiry that is contested by the White House because there hasn't been a vote on having an impeachment inquiry.
I don't think that would mollify them, just for the record. But
I'm just saying, as written, the objection as stated is, look, I'm not a lawyer, but in a what I can only describe as a legal screed about the impeachment inquiry from the White House. Lawyers can correct me if there's some deep legal substance to it. And so the
I think we found out that President Trump was the one who wrote it. So how legal it was is probably a decent debate.
So as a consequence of that, the White House has been telling/directing elements of its executive branch not to cooperate with the inquiry. And so that means not producing documents. And we saw that with most notably the letter from DOD to its committees, even though the secretary had committed to cooperating, and notes in the letter that they are preserving documents to cooperate once the disagreement is resolved.
Note also that letter was not signed by the secretary anyway. Fair.
Though it was signed by their general counsel, right? No, their assistant of legislative
ASD
affairs.
ASD for Leg Affairs.
So I was like, if it had been signed by the general counsel, you might feel a little bit better because they would have some, like, you know, officer of the court responsibilities. I don't think the ASD of Leg Affairs has any responsibilities, but
anyway, we digress.
So, but despite that restriction, some current members of the Foreign Service Officer Corps, most notably the former ambassador to Ukraine, and I believe the ambassador to the EU, Sondland, have both testified and agreed to testify, as have some sort of senior advisors in the State Department. So I think there's a really interesting sort of dynamic set up here of folks just being like, we don't necessarily have to agree with the advice of White House counsel or the White House on these, and our duty is to the Constitution and the American people, and we will come and tell what we know and tell the truth. And that's very interesting, I think, development, both in the substance of what they have, but also in kind of providing top cover for more junior people who may feel compelled to, or may literally be legally compelled to come and testify.
Fiona Hill's lawyer had a point that was basically, and she was the former National Security Council staffer for Russia, or director for Russia, and who testified this week. And his point was that the executive privilege is there to cover, deliberations of a sensitive nature by the White House. And basically he's like, they didn't deliberate on any of this, so we're not protecting it.
That's great. I love that so much.
It was amazing. Like, you know what, guys? Process is your Valentine. And if you had one, you might get some executive privilege to cover it.
One point on all of this that I find to be unfortunate is that so many of the folks being compelled to testify are they're having to hire their own lawyers, because for one, obviously state and DOD are not offering them counsel because they're telling them that they can't testify. But even if they were saying that, like, it's totally fine that you go up and you're going to cooperate, they usually recommend that people seek outside counsel no matter what, which is not a cheap proposition, particularly for our junior level government employees. And most of this counsel, well, I don't want to say most, some portion of it is certainly not pro bono. So there's, if people care about this, there's various funds that you can help donate to help support people who are being part of this investigation and inquiry that's going to go on probably for a long time.
And I will say just one coda to that, and we won't get into it, but for anybody who watched the like Mick Mulvaney presser on, was it Thursday or Friday, where we were told that the president always uses foreign policy to advance parochial political interests and that we should all get over it. I have to say, it strikes me that that's pretty much not true. And it's more than a little offensive.
He accidentally said the inside part out loud.
I don't know that it was an accident. I think he said it super on purpose because he's a corrupt individual. But we'll leave that aside as to why he thought that was a good idea to say it. And just note that we here on the Bombshell podcast are very much in favor of national security and foreign policy being pursued for the public interests and the national security interests. And it is not how it is always done, nor will we get over it.
Also, Lauren, can you correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the head of OMB confirmed by the Senate?
Yes.
Wasn't Mick Mulvaney, isn't he actually, in fact, still the head of OMB?
He is, remarkably. And that is one of the reasons he was doing this press conference to begin with. Because yes, as the head of OMB, he was very much a part of the decision to not allow funds to go to Ukraine for security assistance.
So henceforth, instead of referring to him as acting chief of staff, which, side note, I don't know what that means because it's not a confirmed position, I would like to refer to him as Senate confirmed head of OMB, Mick Mulvaney.
Yeah, I think Mulvaney, I mean, not that this matters a whole lot to this conversation, Mulvaney was already in a weak spot no matter what. They were already seeking possible replacements for him, which, who wants the job of chief of staff of the White House right now? Like, what kind of
zero
horrible
humans
life do you have to have to say that, like, this is a great
Stephen Miller
opportunity for me? Yeah, probably. Be careful what we wish for.
We wanted to talk a little bit about a couple of op-eds that ran this week, and we'll wrap up White House mayhem on a frequent topic here of civil-military relations. Lauren, did you have thoughts on the op-ed from Admiral McRaven?
Yes, and you know what? Aaron, I have a big surprise for you. Radha and I disagree.
I know. It's like
amazing.
Almost never. It was very exciting. We had a Twitter
disagreement. Do tell.
And
do tell.
Okay, so I'll start with the top lines of what's going on in the civil world this week. So McRaven had an op-ed basically saying that President Trump was a danger to our national security. There's more to it than that, but I'll start there. On top of that, there was a National Guardsman who put out a piece in the New York Times, similarly being critical of President Trump's foreign policy in Syria. What's interesting about that is that while he is still in the army, he, because he's a National Guards person and not actually serving on active duty, he has a lot more freedom of speech in what he's able to do to criticize present policy. On top of that, there's been, I don't know how many anonymous special forces and others who are both in the region and outside being wildly critical of the president's policy in Syria, frankly saying terrible things about him as commander in chief. It's been Dan LaMoth, Laura Seligman, dozens of pieces that have come out in that. So the civil community has been having a field day about, is this okay for even, like, clearly they're right in their, or we think that they are right in their criticism of the president, but is it okay for them to do this in as people who are in uniform right now, or in the case of Votel, McRaven and others who were 4 stars.
And Tony Thomas was just on Meet the Press this morning.
Wow. All right, Radha, you and I disagree. So make your case. Sell me.
I'm not going to convince Lauren, but so my feeling on this is twofold. One, I understand the criticism and I can see how it does differ from past norms. Right. So and I think that there's a kind of degrees that matter here. So I think if it were, you know, general minor disagreements on policy, then you might want to really worry about 4 stars, especially retired 4 stars weighing in. I think when there is a grave national security threat and violations to the Constitution, there are some duties and relevance that your expertise and position brings that make it not only acceptable, maybe even good to have people weighing in and saying, hey, this is not a question of Republican or Democrat. This is not a question of partisan. This is fundamentally a question of our sort of nation's principles and constitution. And I think 4-star generals are in as good a position as any former senior national security expert for weighing in. And I kind of recognize that there is a different weight given to that military advice. And we can discuss whether that weight itself is wrong or right. And I tend to sort of side more on Lauren's side with this. But I don't think that means that this sort of community could or should be silenced in those contexts.
I mean, I have questions here. Like, where were these voices when Trump torpedoed the Afghan negotiations, right? Or when John Bolton torpedoed the Afghan negotiations, right?
And I think that's why the degrees piece matters, right? If you think that he was torpedoing the negotiations solely for personal purposes and not because you have a substantive policy disagreement with him, but if you think that he has decided to turn Afghan policy into a lever of personal partisan gain, then I think that that question is fair. But if you're like, this was a stupid ass policy that should have gone through a better process, the president is not a bright person, he's not doing the right things, that's a different kind of disagreement. And I guess the point I'm making is when you feel like the president has sort of fundamentally formed a threat to the Constitution and the Republic as a whole, that imparts a different sort of incentive and acceptability of critique than disagreements on policy substance.
I mean, I guess my thing is, I tend to think the president is a threat to the Republic in a number of ways, but I'm not sure that's best evinced in his Syria policy. And so I'm less clear that they're where those criticisms come from when they, you know, when the secretary, I mean, this goes back to the Mattis resignation, right? When the Secretary of Defense is willing to resign over changes in Syria policy and force posture in the region, but not over sending troops to build a wall at the border or any number of other things. I mean, it is, and maybe this is sort of puts me in Lauren's camp a bit, which is that it remains incredibly fraught because, you know, the judgment required to make these distinctions is substantial.
So I will make a few points of why I find it at least problematic, and we'll hope that McRaven and others have thought through the context in which they are offering these views, which I agree with their views. It's not that I disagree with them and think that like they shouldn't have them. It's more that they need to be very considerate of the precedents that they are setting and also the context in which they are operating. So I'll start with like the most kind of provocative one, which is like, what if McRaven's op-ed or the other points were the opposite, in that Trump has great judgment and we should all vote for him and for national security purposes? Like, what if they were saying things that were wildly divergent with what they're saying right now, we would probably all say like, oh my gosh, they have completely overstepped their bounds. And how dare these current uniform and
But that's a partisan officials. Purpose. That's not a constitutional purpose. It's not responsive to the justification for why they're writing.
If they are saying it for national security reasons, saying that President Trump is for national security reasons the best thing that has happened to Syria policy since sliced bread, then we would all feel much more uncomfortable with it, wouldn't we?
Again, I would, because it would be for a partisan electoral purpose and not for preserving the Constitution. I think if they were like, this other person who is running against Trump is running on a platform of rip up the Constitution, burn it to the ground, and fundamentally change America into an authoritarian dictatorship, I think military people probably should speak out against that. They should say, like, I don't think we should say that we should rip up the Constitution. I think, like, it's not a crazy position for military folks to, like, weigh in on.
Okay. So do you think that people in the military should be able to judge the qualifications of the commander in chief better than anybody else?
No.
And that is very much what McRaven's op-ed was suggesting.
No, he didn't say that they can judge it differently, but that they have sworn an oath.
He absolutely did say that as people in uniform should be able to judge this differently.
Well, let me rephrase. He doesn't say that that is the only judgment that matter, right? And I don't think it does. But I do think, look, if you had a senior ambassador, senior foreign service officer who said, I have spent my career in the foreign service. I have dedicated my life under 5 different presidents to advancing the values of America abroad. And I think that this president is fundamentally destroying those American values. We would think that is actually a valuable contribution to talking about destroying values in the Constitution. And we think that that person, by virtue of their decades-long experience, is weighing in on something that matters. Do you disagree?
I don't disagree. Bill Burns did exactly that, and nobody cares. Because people don't listen to the Foreign Service. People don't listen to civilians in the same way that they listen to sitting military. And their opinion carries significantly more weight, which is why I think they need to be very cautious in exercising their opinion in a political context where they are setting a precedent, even if we are in a series of events that are totally unprecedented. This will be used in the future in other ways as justification for why it's totally okay for the military to be speaking out on matters that they consider to be constitutionally fraught. We're allowing McRaven to say, this is constitutionally fraught, and therefore I get to make this judgment and use my significantly weightier opinion than Bill Burns to be able to say that this
is okay or not.
So
let me ask the question in the other way. Let's say that the military had determined that the president gave them an unlawful order, that they felt that the order given by the president was unlawful, and they viewed it as their duty to speak out, to resist, and to not follow that order. And that charge was led by a 4-star. Do you think
that's
that
totally
they should
awesome.
Not speak publicly about that?
Yep, that's fine.
So there exists a line where you think violations of the... Right. So I think the question is just, did this
degree
rise...
But that's not a
violation
of a norm or UCMJ. That's a norm that we want to enforce.
Well, right. Sorry, Aaron, go ahead.
Well, this is a great example of a number of norms that have been undermined in recent years, and both in terms of our domestic politics and in our foreign policy actions abroad, that we're going to have to struggle to either reinforce, redefine, retrain people on. And, you know, I think reflects a broader symptom that I think we're all sympathetic to, which is the outsized voice that uniformed military, by which I mean senior retired officers, are given in this discussion. And so, you know, I both don't think that we should turn to Army captains for strategy in Syria, nor do I necessarily think that former Special Operations Command commanders are the best, you know, offer the best analysis of what we should be doing in the region either. So, you know, it's...
And if I could end on one point that I think Lauren and I agree on, which is a thing that is missing that I really do wish these senior military folks who want to speak out about could talk more about, is the impact that a lot of these decisions have on the people who are forced to carry them out. So I think there's like a deep and significant human toll, both in terms of sort of mental health effects and in terms of recruitment and retention and quality of the force that these decisions generate. And that I think, I don't know why no one ever talks about it. Guys, personnel stuff is really interesting. And so I think we could really be somewhere and sort of a movement back towards norms. And I think it would be resonant with sort of how the public thinks about service members and cares about service members, but without sort of pushing so hard on the norms that Lauren is concerned about violating.
I agree. Yay.
Yay. Pop culture, ladies. Who has some?
I was really disappointed by my multiple hour flight movie availability. I watched Avengers Endgame and I gotta say I was pretty disappointed. Like, meh.
Do you want to guess what I watched on the flight?
What did you watch?
I watched The Right Stuff. And
wow.
Which of course I've seen many times, but I gotta say Sam Shepard as Chuck Yeager is, yep. I mean, just perfect. Perfection. Just fantastic.
Is Sam Shepard able to play somebody who is not a uniformed service member? Does he have that range, or is he only somebody who serves in the U.S. military?
Oh, no, he's got range. Sometimes he plays a cowboy. It's amazing.
Fair.
Any other pop culture? There's lots of good movies coming out. Watchmen starts on HBO tonight. I think we'll have lots to talk about in the coming weeks, and we'll have to leave it with that. Thanks, everybody. See you soon.